Welcome to the Center for Strategic International Studies, home of excitement on a daily basis. My name is David Berto. I'm the director of the International Security Program here, and I want to welcome you on behalf of our CEO, Dr. John Hamry. Also want to welcome those who have joined us on the web. This will be recorded. The webcast will be available later, so those of you who need to refresh your notes afterwards, you can go back. We do have some view graphs, some charts that we're putting up here. We were refining those up to the last minute. You'll be able to pick those up on the web as well. We're not going to dwell on them a long time, and those of you who are viewing from the web won't be able to see them yet, but you will be able to pick them up later. Joining me today, Mr. Brett Lambert, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Industrial Policy and Manufacturing in the Department of Defense, and Mr. Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners. We are here to talk about the industrial base implications of the fiscal year 2013 defense budget. A couple of administrative details. Number one, would you please silence your cell phones or iPhones or Blackberries or Androids or whatever? There was an interesting set of data I heard the other day. They surveyed phone users. Blackberry users are the most pessimistic. iPhone users are the most optimistic. Android users are the hardest working. You can figure out what you want to give your staff based upon sort of that kind of thing. I think
give them all three.
Right. Give them all three. Let them choose when to be optimistic, when to be pessimistic, when to be hardest working. So I want to start by sort of reflecting where we are, if you will. The President's budget was released 2 days ago. The Defense Department budget was released at the same time. The details are still coming out. As you all know, the budget justification material doesn't all materialize on the first day. It takes several weeks before all the details are ultimately submitted to the Congress, and sometimes several decades before they're actually made available to the general public. But nonetheless, the basic outlines are there already. And we have drawn our initial analysis from the publicly available material and the comments made by the Defense Department officials in doing so. It's important to note a couple of broad framework issues, if you will. Framework issue number one, and many of you know because we covered this a few weeks ago in the session we did right after the Secretary's January 26th announcements of the broad framework of the cuts and how they aligned with the strategic guidance that the President issued back early in January. You know that, in fact, the Defense Department is not planning for, and that the budget guidance from the White House does not demand that they plan for, any impact of sequestration. It incorporates the budget cuts, only incorporate the first half of the cuts mandated by the Budget Control Act of 2011. That is about a little under $490 billion over a 10-year period. It does not deal with the question of sequestration. My interpretation of the overall President's budget, however, is it does, in a way, deal with the sequestration issue. What it says and what it proposes is that the net $3 trillion impact on the reduction of the deficit, this is a combination of cuts and revenue increases, in fact, more than offsets the $1.2 trillion required under the Budget Control Act from sequestration, and therefore, should Congress choose to do so, they now have an analytical basis, an arithmetic basis, to remove sequestration and still meet the targets of the budget. Now, that hasn't yet been widely discussed, although if you watched the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing with the Secretary of Defense yesterday, you know that towards the end of the hearing, Senator Carl Levin brought up this very point with quite a bit of eloquence. I have no idea what the global financial market will think of this and what the ratings agencies will view this as, a sleight of hand or a real deal. And, of course, ultimately, none of it changes. The law of the land is sequestration until Congress changes the law of the land. A budget proposal doesn't change that. Only a statutory enactment will change that. So that's kind of an overall framework, if you will. I want to run through a few charts just to give you a sense of how we're looking at things from an impact on the industrial base. Let me have the first chart, Ryan. This chart you've seen before. It's been updated to reflect the budget. Number one is it's now all in constant FY13 dollars. So every number you had embedded in your head now has to be replaced by a slightly different number. What it really shows is that the budget is coming down. And it shows because we actually don't have a precise number for overseas contingency operations past FY13. There are numbers that are listed, but they're not internally consistent. And we know that there's an overall cap by the administration of $450 billion over 10 years. But we put question marks for the OCO part on this budget for FY14, 15, 16, and 17. What that actually helps see very clearly is this is a flat budget. When adjusted for inflation, it's essentially flat for 5 years. So once you finish the cuts that are there now and take out the inflation impact, it's a flat base budget from here forward. This sort of flies in the face of the image of a dramatically declining defense budget because, you know, the definition of the cuts is not from the amount you're spending, but from the amount you were projecting to spend based on the FY12 submission from the president. So that's an important distinction to make and useful to keep in mind as we go forward. Now let's look at some comparisons. This is a chart, the second chart, I guess, after the title. I don't have a number on mine. This is the base budget. So not including the wartime costs, the overseas contingency operations, divided up by major program account. FY12 enacted is on the left, FY13 request is on the right. So research and development, the FY13 request is down a little bit under 3% from the FY12 enacted. Procurement is down about 5.5% from the FY12 enacted. O&M is up almost 6%, a misleading number, as you will see on the next chart. Military personnel down almost 5%. And the category of other, which is mostly military construction, family housing, and so on, is down about 15%. But now let's combine the base budget with the overseas contingency operations account, next chart. So now we've got total budget authority. FY12 enacted compared to the FY13 requests, again, combining both base budget and supplementals. Our research and development down 3%, procurement down 10% year over year. This is a big impact. O&M is down 4% year over year. You remember the previous chart, if you could go back, Ryan? O&M up 6% in the base budget. Go back, down 4% overall. This means to me a lot of O&M is migrated from the OCO into the base budget, which is probably where it should be, but don't be misled, particularly if in the services contract business and your funding comes from O&M, don't be misled by that 6% increase in the base budget. It's down 4% in the aggregate. Military personnel down about 2.5%. Let me go to the next chart. This is now, by account, the share of the budget on the left-hand side. This is the FY13 budget again, and the share of the cuts. Research and development, largely protected. 11% share of the budget, only got 7% of the cuts. So this is greater protection for R&D. So from a technology investment point of view, good news. And this is consistent with what the department said it was doing. Procurement, 18% of the budget, 38% of the cut. Again, consistent with what the department said. So almost half of the total cuts are taken in the investment accounts, R&D and procurement. That's consistent with what the secretary has been saying for months. Operation and maintenance is about 44% of the budget, only about 35% of the cut. Again, this is combining wartime costs plus base budget. And the real driver here is it's really hard, clearly, to cut military personnel dollars. 24% of the budget, only 12% of the cuts. And that's going to continue to be true throughout the foreseeable future with the size of the force structure cuts that are laid out there. Let me have the next chart. Now I want to look at it by component, Air Force, Army, Navy, and defense-wide. So again, comparing the enacted in FY12 with the request in FY13, Air Force down 4.5%, Army down over 8%, Navy down only 1.4% year over year, and defense-wide down about 5%. Now let's look from a share of the budget point of view, the next chart. Air Force is 11% of the FY13 budget, and they're taking 23% of the cuts. Army is 18% of the FY13 budget. They're taking 53% of the cuts. A lot of this, of course, is OCO cuts and the Army share of OCO cuts, and it does reflect the reduction in force in Afghanistan that's projected. Navy, 25% of the budget, 7% of the cut. And defense-wide is roughly proportional, 17% of the budget, 17% of the cuts. When the Secretary made his announcements back in January, there were not a lot of program terminations announced. And there were a number of stories there that these cuts aren't really as bad as we had feared there would be. In fact, I believe that yours truly may actually have said something to that effect sitting in this very chair on the next day. It could be a lot worse. It turns out when you look at the actual details, and this chart is just a notional list, it's not one I expect you to be able to read or memorize, there are a substantial number of terminations, a lot of program restructurings, and in almost no cases does that mean an accelerated or increased buy. Program restructuring here means we're not buying as many of them and we're stretching them out a lot further. There's also a little bit of funny arithmetic embedded in some of here. I note that we're saving way more money on the P8s that we took out than we're spending on the ones that we kept in, and I'm not quite sure how that arithmetic works because it usually goes the other way. And, of course, we have a number of retirements. Now, these are not eliminating all of the C5As or all of the KC-135s, but large numbers, if you will. And these are cuts, consolidations, and savings that are listed by category here. In some cases, there are companies that are going to be dramatically impacted by this. There, of course, what I don't show on the list is where other money is still being spent. And in the aggregate, the impact on any given company depends on all the programs, not just on one program. There are two other questions I'll leave you with. You can go back to the main screen now, Ryan, if you would. One is on the services side. And, you know, half of defense contracting now is services contracting rather than contracting for products or goods. It's a lot harder to tell what the impact is going to be. Notwithstanding the 4% reduction in operation and maintenance, which is where most of that services contracting comes from, the distribution of those cuts is, in fact, not yet determined. And as you know, the operation and maintenance account is a very large account. It doesn't have much requirements in terms of specificity in it. It'll depend on the demand. And services contracts tend not to be generated by top-down demand. They tend to be generated by bottom-up requirements, installation by installation, command by command, activity by activity, operation by operation. And only after you roll it all up do you know whether, in fact, you've met your target or not. There is no real-time management system in the Department of Defense or anywhere in the federal government that says, whoops, you're only 4% away from your cap, you have to stop spending money. You know you're 4% away from your cap 3 months later after it's way too late to do anything about it. And from a services contracting point of view, this is both good news, that is, you're probably not going to get cut off until later, and bad news, once later arrives, it's going to be really hard. And it'll remain to be seen whether the efficiencies that DOD has programmed in can actually be managed in such a way that they produce something other than a termination or a failure to exercise an option at the least opportune time in terms of the way the companies. The next point is that there is a part of the industrial base that's not really covered in the numbers we put here, although they are buried in the accounts. And that is the part of the industrial base that the Defense Department itself owns. Mostly these are the maintenance and repair facilities and depots. And as you can see, both from last year's National Defense Authorization Act and from the discussions already up on the Hill yesterday and today with the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, protecting the depots is something that is of great interest to a lot of members. And in a declining budget, you can only protect the depot's share by taking more money away from industry. My final point has to do with the impact of these cuts and the ability to mitigate those impacts. The Defense Department has actually probably the most unique capability left in the federal government for managing impact on communities, on workers, on factories when they're closed, et cetera. We used to have a very robust capability across the federal government. It resided in the Commerce Department. That's essentially gone, has been gone for some time now. The Defense Department still has that capability, not because of industry, but because of base closures. And in many ways, the community planning that goes into place when you close a base is the same kind of community planning process you need when you close a factory. And that capability is going to come, I suspect, under greater use over the coming years than it has been in the past few, both because of base closures and because of factory reductions. So I'm going to turn to Brett Lambert, who's going to talk a little bit about, if you can see through the coffee stains of the coffee I spilled on his papers here.
I may fall asleep, but my paper is wide awake.
So let me turn over to you, and then you can pass it to Byron.
Sure. Thanks very much. I'm not going to speak for very long, because I think the discussion will be most useful, particularly as there's a lot of questions given the budget rollout. I just wanted to highlight a few things. We tend to, in this industry, to think in terms of the immediacy. What does it mean today? What did you do today? What are you doing to mitigate today? And I just wanted to step back a little bit from the department's point of view. And I view us as, in essence, on chapter three of a book. I'm not quite sure how many chapters there's going to be. But when the administration began, which I would refer to as chapter one, and we really revitalized this this office in particular, the Manufacturing Industrial Base Office, it was with an eye toward, there was the idea of never-ending double-digit year-over-year growth in defense spending was not sustainable under any scenario. Now, it was dependent upon, obviously, the progress in the ongoing conflicts was the first priority, and we weren't going to do anything to shortchange that, of course. But I was asked when I first came in, as I've joked with you guys before, to think outside the box, and then I got there and realized my box had five sides. To think about the industrial base in a way that we hadn't done for quite some time. And it ranged everything from the manufacturing facilities, the capabilities of technology, to IRAD, a lot of the things that everyone in this room is concerned with. And with that in mind, we were tasked specifically over 2 years ago to look at previous downturns. This was before we had made these downturns, and it was in preparation for things like the Abilene speech that Secretary Gates gave. But we really did make a conscious effort to go back and look how the industrial base was affected in previous downturns. What did we get right, and what did we get wrong? And of the previous swings in overall macro level, you know, you had the wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Those were war-inspired. And then you had, in essence, Hart-Scott-Rodino, then further accelerated by the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And in each case, when we looked back, the department, sometimes because of our own policies, got it wrong. We left a force in place that wasn't adequate to the needs of the department and certainly to the demands on the military, and specifically related to the industrial base. That was a concern that both Secretary Gates and former Deputy Secretary Lynn and then Under Secretary Carter it went into a lot of their thinking as we began to develop the strategic guidance. So, in essence, we were 0-for-4 as a department, and I think those of you who worked on the study or were familiar with the study realized that we had to do something different this time. So I'm just going to run through the lessons learned because they're evident, and this is pulling the thread from the budget, from the strategic guidance to the budget to what we're talking about today, the impact on the industrial base, which really is part of our force structure. So the five broad lessons that drove from our perspective, again, from an industrial base perspective, was you had to make the hard decisions early. Now, David put up there a chart of some of the programs that were terminated in this go-around, but we all know of the other programs in the past 2 years that have been terminated, not because we didn't want them, but because, frankly, we couldn't afford them. You've seen the figures, $300 billion in total program. There's already been a great culling of programs. Once again, not because we didn't want them or we didn't think that we needed them, we just couldn't afford them. And what we learned from the lessons of previous drawdowns is you have to make those tough decisions early because the fiscal situation just is not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And even well-run programs overrun their budget estimates for reasons that are beyond the control of either the contractor or the government. The second lesson is that you're not going to generate the required savings that you want by pure efficiencies. It's just not going to happen. We plan for efficiencies. You see some of those numbers in our budget. We're going to get better at IT. Everyone's always going to get better at efficiencies. But you're not going to make the kind of numbers that we're talking about with pure efficiencies alone. Although that doesn't mean you shouldn't try and aggressively pursue those, they're not going to get you to the levels of savings that that we need. The third, and I think the chart in the budget that David just showed highlights how seriously we took this, both in the strategic guidance and in the budget formation, is it has to be done in a balanced way when you make these reductions. You can't hollow out a force through procurement alone. You can't cut just O&M. You have to do it in a balanced way, and I think you're seeing that. And one thing that will be interesting is as we get greater, as people review the budget numbers, I think what you'll see is in your numbers you show a disproportionate share on the procurement side, but part of that is that's where the early savings can come from. And, you know, other savings that you may generate, whether it be in O&M in particular, are longer-term savings. So as you cut force structure, you get a bigger bang for each buck in the out years than you do in the early years. So if you look across the FYDP, and not just across the FYDP, but further on, you'll see that I think that balance that we've tried to enforce in this budget or reflect in this budget is true. And the fourth lesson was don't cut too fast too quickly. And this, I found it surprising when I read through some of the commentary in the budget. Well, to your point, well, they didn't cut that much. And that's one of the side of the commentary. And then the other side is, oh, they gutted the defense. So you're, you know, the fact is we've tried to take a very balanced approach. We know that, and this was the whole concept behind reversibility, we know that to rebuild capability takes a long time, at great cost, and sometimes that cost is not measured in dollars, it's measured in lives, as it was in the Korean conflict. And so we wanted to be mindful to not cut too much too quickly, and to make sure we had instituted the ability to reverse decisions. Now, a lot of that was on force structure, but it applied to the industrial base as well, and we can talk in the discussion about some specific areas there. And then the fifth, which was really in my domain, which is be mindful of the industrial base as you're making these cuts. And that leads me to the second chapter in all of this. As we led up to the 13 budget, the first time that in the 20 years I've been working in the sector, our office was truly engaged, not as a because they wanted the to be able to say we worried about the industrial base, but those of you from my office and my staff and those of you who had filled out all of those surveys over the last year or so can attest, we took industrial base quite seriously in the formation of this budget. And that is the second chapter. We looked at the impacts of critical capabilities in the industrial base. Now, we can spend a long time discussing what exactly is the industrial base. It's not the primes. That is part of the industrial base, but it's certainly not the only critical component of the industrial base. So we went down very far into the tiers, the sub-tiers, and the critical components that had both criticality and fragility that were critical to the systems that we want to preserve in the out years, that we want to make sure we have access to. And those are where we concentrated. And we did make some specific programmatic decisions in 13. We also set up a process through what is now called the DMAG and through all of our major program reviews where this brings me to Chapter 3, what we're doing with 13 and beyond, where the 14 budget, we will be examining as part of the review process the impacts on the defense industrial base. If you will, 13 was a pilot project where we took some key systems and we ran them through a methodology that we created, and we got the services comfortable with that and the SAEs comfortable with it. And it will, as we move into 14, be the guide, that procedure for evaluating all of our major defense programs to make sure that we don't have unintended consequences as we move forward. And if we do make decisions, they're informed decisions, whether those be terminations or in scaling back capability. So we're in Chapter 3 now. I'm anxious to see what happens in Chapter 4, but I think we're on a good path, at least in terms of the industrial base that we have.
Before I turn the microphone over to you, Byron, I would comment that I'm looking forward to actually seeing the FITIP and beyond the FITIP so that we can verify that, and we're looking forward to being able to see the additional details of this budget as soon as they're available. Byron, what's it look like from the investor side here?
It actually looks fairly benign. I'll talk a little bit about kind of my impressions about the cuts that were made, and then just the market reaction to these cuts, how the shareholders of these companies responded to the budget rollout. A couple of quick observations on the procurement and RDT&E program. David put up the nice chart that summarized what the major program changes were. I think my only observation would be when I got into some of the program justification books, there was a bit of surprise about the quantity on some things that were cut. Joint Strike Fighter had been telegraphed, but when you got into P-8, the Hawkeye, THAAD interceptors, it was kind of expected given the way changes were coming, but when you really saw the details, there were a couple of things that hadn't been discussed in the January 26 briefing, and I think even in the context of the broader strategy. When I think about kind of the risk to the industrial base and the impact of these cuts on the industrial base, there's really not a lot that jumps out from my perspective. I suppose the FMTV cut and the impact on the truck industrial base, the military truck industrial base might be one area, but you think about there's a pretty robust commercial truck business in the United States between Navistar, Cummins, Caterpillar in the engine side. So if you think about places where the Department of Defense may be able to take risk in the industrial base, that's one that would seem to not be a terrible concern in the grand scheme of things. I suppose the other risk is just the impact on unit prices, particularly for the F-35 program. I think Tom Burbidge of Lockheed was in Norway yesterday and talked about unit prices going up. So that'll be another risk that I think we'll just have to see play out in the coming days, weeks, and months, and how a lower buy in the F-35 will impact the international demand for that product. And I'm sure we could hear that on some of the other programs as well. The market reaction to all this was really fairly benign. I was thinking about this morning. This budget season seemed like Christmas. It used to be the Christmas decorations went up in right after Thanksgiving. Now it seems they're up around Halloween, and all of a sudden the budget cycle seems to start in at least for the investment community in the pass back in January, whereas, yeah, you know, it used to be right around the president's State of the Union address. But if I look at how the stocks have behaved, they've really handled this very well. The market is having a pretty good year so far. The S&P 500 is up around 8%. Lockheed, which is really the bellwether here, is about keeping pace with the market. There are some stocks that have done better. Huntington Ingalls, which actually was the shipbuilding business at Northrop Grumman, spun off. I think that's up 17% year to date. And I think with the strategy rollout and the emphasis that was placed on the Navy, go back to some of the concerns about are we going to cut a carrier or not, and what's going to happen to the submarine program, to David's chart about how the Navy fared, the market, I think, did appropriately realize that Huntington Ingalls was not going to be harmed as much as people had feared from this. There were a couple of reactions to point out on the day of the budget release. Oshkosh, I think, was down 4%. So the FMTV program, you know, it's going to be something to watch for them. Another stock that I keep an eye on, AeroVironment. They make the small handheld UAVs, was down a bit, but it's squirrely to really figure out what's in the budget and what actually falls their way out of OCO. So I don't think that's a fundamental change for them. One final point about the stock market and how the stock market reacts to all these budget changes. I think it's important to recognize that, particularly for the large stocks, Lockheed Martin I'll single out, but the other large primes are true of this too. They're in a position now where they're paying out a lot of their cash flow in dividends. And when you have a 4.6% dividend yield on your stock, it can really make a company much more impervious to some of these budget changes. I think as long as people feel that the cash flow is going to be there in 2013, 14, 15, and 16 to cover the dividend in the current interest rate environment, you know, that those kind of yields are actually a very sound anchor for these stocks. I still think we're going to see volatility in the small to mid-size category, but looking at the bellwethers, the large companies to be bellwethers for how budgets are influencing investor expectations, these dividend yields are really unprecedented in the way these companies have behaved in the past. Those are my remarks.
Thank you, Brett, and thank you, Byron. One last comment, and then we'll open the floor up for questions. It's always, I look out at the audience, there's a lot of old Washington hands here, some of you not old in sense of age, but you've been at it for a while. You know, it's important for us to remember that the budget that has been put on the table here is the president's proposal. The Congress has yet to, in fact, make its decisions here. It's pretty easy to look through and see a number of things that are in trouble. It's perhaps not as likely as Secretary of Defense would like it to be that all of the force structure reductions in the Air National Guard will in fact be enacted into law. History says that doesn't usually happen. So there are a host of things here where, as the year plays out, as the authorizers mark up and the appropriators mark up and bring their bills to the floor, we'll see some of these things change, if you will. When the Secretary of Defense laid out his budget justification back on January 26th, he made the point, and it was included in his book, that, in fact, this is a complete package and you can't change anything in it. What he really meant was if you take something out, you have to add something else back in. And in other words, if part of the cuts are rejected, then the only way you can sustain compliance with the Budget Control Act is to find someplace else to cut. I don't think you're going to see that initially. The House Armed Services Committee is already making noises. They did it in their hearing today about adding money back to the defense budget. There's no plausible scenario in which they can do that that's still compliant with the sequestration of the Budget Control Act that has the votes to pass the Congress. So there'll be a fair amount of activity in March, April, May that will look like the budget's coming back and some of these things are being rescued, if you will, in terms of the cuts. But in reality, in the end game, come September and then again after the election, it's likely that most of those plus-ups, those add-backs, will disappear in the final endgame. And I think it's really useful to keep that in mind as we go through the year here. There'll be a flurry of activity that looks positive. I'm quite certain the market is able to tell the difference here. They seem to make money even where I don't, so I have to assume they're better than I am at this. And they'll recognize that, in fact, that's just an illusion or a blip, if you will, and then in reality, when we come back down, we'll be where we started in the aggregate. So with that as a final comment, I'm going to throw the floor open to question. If you're on the web and you have a question, you can email me at my first initial last name, dberteau@csis.org, and I'll pick up the question here on my silent but working optimistic iPhone. And if you're in the audience, you raise your hand. We have microphones. You wait for the microphone, identify yourself, your affiliation, and then ask your question, and we'll do our best to respond to it. So do we have questions in the audience here? And if you would come down to the middle here in the front, we'll start with the first question there.
Sir, George Nicholson from StratCorp. Byron, you sort of alluded to it, but yesterday at the symposium, senior acquisition executive for the Air Force, Mr. Van Buren, alluded to the issue of the F-35 pushing things to the right and the, quote, assumption that that's going to be supported by our partners in the program. We've already seen what's happening with the British backing out on the F-35B. We've seen the nervousness on the part of the Canadians, the Australians. What's the confidence level of pushing that program to the right and the increase in the unit price that's not going to have a major impact on our overseas partners and whether they're going to back out of it?
I think, you have to separate some of this from, what's going on with the budget in the United States and the changes that have been made programmatically here and then the fiscal crises in Europe. Certainly Italy, I think, was in the press today saying they were cutting some number 40 F-35s from their plan. I think it's going to be, a mix and match. Japan had placed an order, so they're probably going to be some delivery slots that they're going to pick up. There's a pretty important competition coming up in South Korea that's supposed to be decided by year end, so that potentially could be a source of additional slots. But I think we're really talking about the rate of the ramp, not a point where there's a bow in that ramp or a downturn, at least assuming the program kind of keeps plugging along through its tests here.
If I could add one thing to that also, Byron, we've been tracking trends in European defense spending for some time here, and we put out regular reports on that. And intriguingly, inside the aggregate of Europe, the account that has been best protected over the last decade is actually the procurement account. It has suffered fewer cuts than anything else. Now, in part, that's because of the European tendency to spend money on indigenous companies inside the country. So it's not always just to procure, it's also to sustain jobs. We've been expecting for some time that trend will change and the procurement accounts would start being reduced. We were surprised last year to discover, in fact, the reverse was happening. They actually went up between fiscal year 10 and 9. I don't think we're going to see that again. I think they're coming down for good now. But it'll be a great excuse to be able to blame a cut you want to make anyway on the U.S. decision to make it harder, if you will. And it'll be very hard for us to extract one from the other. Other questions? I'm going to go with one in the middle here, Andy, and then hang around the mic, and we'll bring it over you can bring it over here. Josh, you can have it over there.
Jim Asker with Aviation Week. Mr. Lambert, could you give us an example of a decision that was made specifically to protect the industrial base? Maybe a company that was kept going that barring that consideration, would have lost its work.
Sure, as long as Byron isn't listening. there are examples, and I know that's what everyone wants. When I talk about pulling the thread from a strategic guidance even before that to a budget to industrial base, let me give you one from Chapter 1, what I would call Chapter 1, which was when we first came into office, and Dr. Carter has spoken of this, as has Mr. Kendall, we were faced with the termination of the Next Generation Bomber. And in practice, how that would have been done in the past was a termination of a program, a PE removed, and then sprinkled back through R&D efforts in various phases. And we made a fairly conscious, it was a very long involved process, I can assure you, of looking at the teams that were involved in that time. At that time, there were two teams. And thinking through what it was that was unique about that particular industrial base, where we knew we were going to, at some point in time, need to have the capabilities, particularly the design capabilities. And we made a conscious effort to fund programs in a very constrained environment, to fund the three efforts ongoing so that we could now be at the point we are now. So we sustained these design teams. We made those investments. And they weren't money, you know, we weren't throwing money for money's sake. And I have to say, nobody in the department, except I'm going to use it now, has used the word bailouts. We're not bailing out companies. We're talking about intervening when it's completely in our self-interest to invest in capabilities that we're going to need for programs of the future and retain the competition, in this case, that we want to encourage. And so Next Generation Bomber was a classic example. Another example that's more immediate and not nearly as sexy are things like the procurement of making sure there's a steady base for items like ammonium perchlorate, which is an ingredient essential to all of our solid rockets, both strategic and tactical. There we had a case where not just the Department of Defense, but where NASA, our sister agency, terminated a shuttle program. It was about 70% of our solid buy. We woke up to find that we were a tail, not a dog, and that's not it's an unusual position for the department. But when we looked at the base carefully, we realized that while the primes that were involved in this effort were important and we needed to do what we could to stabilize those buys, there were critical subcomponents that nobody had been talking about that we needed to go in and make sure we identified the necessary sustainable rate to get these subcontractors out of what I call the EKG environment, where we buy, you know, 51 year one, the next. I'm from business. You can't run a business that way. So figure out a way to make it a sustainable rate, work with across the services and across the programs within the services to create sustainable rates of production, and that's exactly what we did in that case.
Jeff Green with Green & Company. Mr. Lambert, question on your statement about making programmatic decisions based on criticality and fragility. Can you speak a little bit to the methodology that you use to determine criticality and fragility in a very, very large industrial base, and then the mechanism that you use to transfer those determinations down to the program manager level?
Good question. Could we go to chart 6, please? Again, this is between chapter and two. And when I think about this from an industrial-based perspective, we're trying to come up with a methodology that's both repeatable and we can use across programs. So, again, this is a work in progress. But when you think about a program, particularly at the sub-tier levels, and it was mentioned track vehicles, and so I can tell you anything you want to know about axles and wheel suspension and that's where you have to go down. You have to go down to that level. Because as everyone in this room knows, probably 20 years ago, maybe 50% or even more than that of every dollar that went to a prime stayed at the prime. Well, the fact is now that as soon as that dollar hits the prime, it's being dispersed among a global supply chain, among thousands of components, thousands of companies, many of which are not in the U.S., particularly in the IT side. So we looked at along two axes, criticality, which are those characteristics that make a product or service difficult to replace if we were to make a change. Is it defense unique, or are there other systems that are out there, commercial systems? And then along the other axis is fragility. Were changes that we were going to make in the budget, would it have an effect on the company in question? And here's part of the important part of the S2T2 survey and the general dialogue that we're having with our defense partners, which is we need them to be competitive for capital. We have to make sure that they're financially viable, which means they can compete for capital along with every other industry. So we get worried when their access to capital is restrained. specifically, I get concerned, and so does the leadership of the department, if it's constrained because of policies we put in place, which is why we place this emphasis on we're not going after profits. We want to encourage profitability of companies. We want to reward companies that are profitable. So that's what we look at in the fragility point of view. And if you go to the next slide, and I blinded this, but this is basically a chart that we're using, and we're going to use it in PB14 across all of the different sectors. So this is just one program down at the second and third tiers of some of their critical components. And we're looking at where's criticality and where's fragility. And this allows us then at an OSD level across programs, across services, to look and say, well, we have a particular problem with some widget here. Is that, are we seeing that thread throughout the industrial base? Do we need to do something, either steady production, move production to the left, or in some cases to the right? Think about alternatives, whether they be in components. Are there other systems that can be brought in? And all this really does is allow us to visualize and focus in on a greater investigation of those that are starting to creep to the right. And that's, as you know, this sector-by-sector, tier-by-tier effort is not a study. It's a process that we're building so that we can track over time, are we seeing criticality starting to move to the right in a certain area, a greater dependence. And in some of the cases we've seen, frankly, when you see criticality moving to the right, it might mean that program offices and department are behind the curves technologically, that the commercial world has moved on, and maybe it's time for us to move on as well and to look for other elements. So this data, when we have the data, can really support a lot of different decisions. It also supports, in Byron's world, our reviews of mergers and acquisitions, of vertical integration, of foreign activity in the U.S. So this is the kind of data-driven analysis that we're committed to performing in the department on the industrial base, particularly at the second and third tier levels.
Thank you. Sandra Irwin with National Defense. I had a question for Mr. Lambert, too. This is about the number of congressional hearings that have been going on in the past year, and I believe you testified at one of them on the opening up the market for small businesses and opening up the market to non-traditional defense suppliers. And there seems to be a lot of complaining on the parts of the members of these committees that it's not happening. So I know this is an old issue that's been going on forever. So do you ever see a resolution to this issue? And how do you address their complaints?
We make strides in the department. Of course, we're committed to meeting our goals in the small business activity. That is where a lot of innovation, most of our innovation comes from, so we try to encourage it. In my particular office, I'm focused on producibility, so I'm focused on pulling things through from R&D into production and manufacturing. But there are a lot of activities there. I think, you know, we try to become more commercial for all the right reasons, right? It lowers our overall cost. It allows us to get access to new technologies. But I think you have to be realistic about the environment that we have in defense. We require our systems to last a long time. They're not disposable. Our market is really based on a concept of high barriers to entry. And those high barriers to entry are both good for historic defense industries, but they make it difficult for new entrants to come into. So we're all for trying to lower the barriers to entry for all the reasons that every economist will tell you. But we have to do so carefully because at the end of the day, we want companies and technologies that are in our sector for the long haul. And this is what we refer to as we want, you know, more Warren Buffetts, fewer Gordon Geckos. We want companies and we want to reward companies who are dedicated to our marketplace and the unique needs of the department. And then we want to take advantage of small innovative companies as we can. But the risks are too great to just do away with all of the requirements that we have in essence to protect our base and just open it up to anyone, including foreign companies that would want to come in.
Can I add something to that?
Notwithstanding that eloquent defense of the Defense Department's inability to actually meet its targets for small business set-asides, the facts speak otherwise. You actually not only have met those targets, you've exceeded them, and the data have been growing in your direction.
Yep.
We put out last May a defense contract spending report. We'll be updating it shortly with the FY11 data. And it shows that that the percentage of small business is well over 20% in terms of contracts in the services arena particularly, and it's been growing over time. The same is true across the federal government. Now, the problem is that that masks the real impact of dollars, because the real impact is not prime contract dollars that flow to small businesses, but total dollars that flow to small business. They will be a prime with dollars going to a large subcontractor. Small businesses may be a sub getting dollars from, and there's no good federal data that captures actual dollar flows to small businesses. Until that data is in place, it's going to be hard for us to really tell the impact of the policy decisions. And the only way the data is going to get to be in place is if the government pays for it, because it's not in the interest of the companies to keep that information without the government reimbursing them for it. And in the current budget situation, the likelihood that you're going to spend more money for data that you didn't get when you had a lot of money is pretty low.
But we're getting some of that. That's a great point. We're getting some of the data through the S2T2 database, and Dr. Eugene Goles is here, and Ellen is here somewhere, I think, in our office, right, who are working on it. We're getting some of that data. But you're exactly right. When you, for instance, it's unlikely that the Department of Defense is going to give a prime contract award to a small business for an aircraft carrier. So when you take a huge chunk of money like that, it does distort, in some cases, how other agencies behave. But then when you look at where the money goes from that carrier down, the participation among small and medium-sized businesses grows exponentially, and we do quite well on those numbers. But sometimes it does get distorted because of the nature of the things that we buy.
Let's move back over to the south side of the building here.
Good afternoon. Mike McCarthy, Defense Daily. This question is for Mr. Lambert, and something Byron alluded to earlier about the cuts with regard to shipbuilding turned out to be rather modest and better than, not as bad as some expected. And I'm wondering if you guys reached a red line on that, if you reached a conclusion that any additional cuts would have actually been damaging to the industrial base.
Well, I mean, I think Byron, you're right. He not only hit on it, he hit exactly the right phrase. This is not a question of what we like. It's a question of what risk we can absorb in this rather dramatic 487 that we are asked to take. So it's a question of balancing the risks. And when you talk about reversibility in particular, and you look across the portfolio of systems, long lead items that require a long time to change if you make decisions are obviously ones that are more difficult to reverse than others. But I don't think I wouldn't say that at least in the meetings I've participated in that there was any more weight given to specific programs. It was really about balancing the risks across programs that we had.
And we heard the Navy, we haven't seen the long-term shipbuilding plan yet, obviously, in terms of the details. We heard the Navy say that despite the cuts in the budget, that the number of ships in FY17 will be the same as it is today, roughly 285, and that it'll actually grow into the low 300s by sometime in the 2020s. Now, we have to see the numbers and what those ship types are, obviously, before we can validate and ascertain that. But I suspect it's more of a conscious commitment to sustaining the Navy than it is to sustaining the industrial base that sustains the Navy. But the two are slightly connected.
I think that's fair. Again, in all of the decisions, it would be rare for us to make a large multi-billion-dollar programmatic decision based on a single factor. An industrial base would be counted as a single factor. They all have to be taken in context in concert with the strategic guidance that we're trying to achieve.
Thank you.
Next question. We're run out of questions. I've got the threat of adjourning class is always a dangerous.
Amber Corin, Federal Computer Week. Secretary Panetta has talked a lot about focusing on science and technology, and areas like cyber were one of the few areas to actually get a boost in the budget. So what kind of implications does that have for industry?
Yeah, I'll let you.
The simple word is sure, positive. From the standpoint of someone who looks at mid to large size publicly traded companies, it's hard to really see it. I mean, I think there's a floating definition of what actually constitutes cyber. So some of the companies will talk about, we have $2 billion in cyber, and you actually find out a lot of that is IT, you know, with some form of protection in it. There was, I think, a $3.5 billion budget item that was called out in the FY13 release for Cyber Command, but it's a bigger market than that. And I think clearly it's going to be a trend. I think the hard part from the outside is just kind of getting your arms about, well, what actually is that market? How big is it? How fast will it grow? How many people are you going to get involved in? And it's mm-hmm. going to come down to how you define it. So
it's hard to hug a cloud. Yeah, it's
I don't enjoy hugging my computer even when it's real. But there's an aspect of this that I think is easily masked, and it's hard to tell the impact of the budget, and that is the character of the workforce itself, and particularly the ongoing problem that I think we're having in sustaining both the supply of eligible and the demand for competent science, technical engineering, and mathematics people. The Secretary was actually asked about this yesterday before the Senate, and his comment was a non-analytical comment. He basically said, you know, I go around and we sure got lots of great young people working for us, and I know that's to be true. But that masks the long-term demand and supply equation that we have in place, and clearly this is way bigger than defense. But it is a critical question to defense industry, and it's a critical question both because of demographics and because of changing technology. Obviously, it spills over into things like immigration issues and so on. But I think the near-term effect of the FY13 budget is immeasurable there. The long-term problem is quite serious.
I'd just say it's like most things. It's a more complicated question than you would think. I mean, cyber is now a ubiquitous requirement in all of our programs. Cyber protection of not just the defense industrial base and the players. If you think about all where most of our most treasured assets are, they're not in the U.S. government. And as I've said many times, we don't make anything. It's our defense industrial base, which is why they're part of the force structure, should be considered part of the force structure. So as a normal course of doing business, and in operation, cyber is going to have to be at the forefront of people's minds because the protection of that data is going to becoming increasingly essential by the hour, if not by the minute.
We've got a couple more questions here on the front row.
Tim Keating, I spent a few years in the Navy. friends in the consulting world are already dusting off their "You can't possibly close Mayport, Fort Bliss, Oceana." Can you give us your sense of the appetite for base realignment and closure in CONUS and OCONUS? Thank you.
Well, it's not, again, it's not in our, I'm learning the hard way after several years in the Pentagon. I'm supposed to first identify when I'm not supposed to talk about something. I'm not supposed to talk about this because it's not in my purview. But I can tell you that that you talked about a little bit, and David, you alluded to it. There are many things that we need to do to be rational in the defense budget. And I think the argument that the Secretary has put forth stands on its face on the merits about the need for another round, two rounds of these BRACs. Our role from the manufacturing industrial policy perspective is how to ensure that as we go forward with these necessary changes, the industrial base is not in those areas or in those sectors is to the greatest degree possible, whether it be through organizations like the Office of Economic Assistance, which is a great operation that, again, talking about remembering the previous BRAC rounds we had, or through its other programs that we have in the department, that we minimize the impact to the extent possible and to the extent that's in the interest of the department. But I think at the end of the day, you know, this is one where we were asked to make a number. We've shown, demonstrated the savings over time of BRACs, and I think it's hard to argue with that, even if there's upfront costs, what those savings are. And we've complied with the Budget Control Act, and that's what we believe needs to happen, and it'll be up to Congress. As you know, that's not within our control.
Admiral, as you know, I have more than passing experience with base closures, and it's clear that there are two big hurdles that have to be dealt with here. One is essentially the broad perception of a fiasco in the 2005 base closure round, and that perception in some cases may be warranted, in other cases is because of the arithmetic. It doesn't make sense to look at a base closure when your force structure is increasing and judge what you would do in base closures when your force structure is decreasing. And we're clearly in a scenario now where the force structure is decreasing. You can't take the level of cuts on a percentage basis that we showed, even in 1 year, and with a flat budget going forward, and say that that in fact we don't have excess capacity. And when you don't have enough money to go around, it's inevitable that you're going to waste it on that excess capacity unless you figure out how to get rid of it. I think the Secretary said, and this is absolutely the case, base closures is no fun, and nobody wants to do it. But nobody has come up with a better way of dealing with how do you get rid of excess capacity and do it in a fair and balanced way that actually takes account not only of the politics, but most importantly, of the military value for the Department of Defense. And until somebody comes up with a better way, it's by far the best way to go. I think there's, you know, you're hearing on the Hill a lot of hemming and hawing. Almost nobody's coming out in favor of it, but most people are recognizing the reality that you're going to have to figure out how to do this, and you're better off doing it up front and open-minded with a little lead time than do it like we did at the end of the Cold War with 2 months' notice. And we're way better off if we do this in a deliberate and focused fashion. And I think with a focus on retaining the capacity that we need to have and maximizing the savings rather than maximizing the expenditures. So another question in the front, and then we've got one on the side here.
Mr. Lambert, Bob Ewers from Hyde Analytics. The department entered into a unique relationship on commercial imagery, generating cost savings to the department over time. I was curious if you could address, there's in the budget release, there was mention of a restructuring. Are you concerned that that restructuring jeopardizes your future ability to enter into those kinds of relationships?
I'd say we're mindful of both the demand side and the consequences, and that particular case is one where we're looking at industrial base considerations. I can't say much more about it because it's an ongoing process, but I was involved in the initial negotiations for that. I know the importance when he talked about using the commercial marketplace. We understand the importance of leveraging commercial assets, and we understand living up to the statements we've made, and so we're reviewing it right now. Again, there's a question of demand and supply, and we're trying to judge all of those things as we move forward and get what I believe will be a more realistic assessment of our needs over time.
I think I have a question here.
Pierre Rasmussen from the Danish Embassy here in town. I was wondering if we're talking about extending the industrial base or level as now or decreasing the industrial base in this country with regards to defense. For sure, I see a tendency to urge the U.S. companies to do more business outside the U.S. as they see the market here maybe decreasing. Very interesting, and some of the foreign countries like Denmark would like to see some business go back if we buy your products. We don't get received, we're not always that popular when we come the other way and try to sell to you guys. Also, your president is very determined on jobs for Americans and other things, so those signals are hitting us. And one of the things I really got struck by is I see that the Foreign Comparative Testing Program, a program that's been on for many years and saved the American taxpayers a two-digit million-dollar amount, has been cut about 30% in the 2012 budget. So I just would like to hear the panel's view on, are we building walls against the Europeans coming in or others coming in with products and that thereby stabilizing the U.S. industrial base, or where are we going, which direction?
He's written quite a bit about it. You've talked about the financial side. I'll just say from our point of view of the department, as I've said many times, it's a fact that our base is more global, it's more commercial, and it's more financially complex. And when I say global, if you look at the top 10 companies at the prime level, you'll see many in there that are what I refer to as non-heritage companies. These are companies that weren't founded here but operate here just as U.S. companies. So we're interacting directly with a number of again, these non-heritage companies, we rely on them. We treat them as you would any company that was founded here. exports are incredibly important to not just our ability to manufacture at scale, but to keep financial viability within within the base, both domestic and non-heritage companies. And we're trying to break down the barriers on our export restrictions as much as we can, so that we can allow our industries to be competitive globally. And I think just I know you mentioned that particularly the Foreign Cooperative Test Program, which is an excellent program, but I think what you've seen over time is that where that used to be the primary way of systems entering our supply stream, now you're seeing more industry-to-industry cooperative efforts, not government-to-government. There's a handful of those, and we can all list the difficulties they've had. But when industry, when companies are allowed to team, when companies are allowed to share data and products and progress, we're seeing a much more, much greater rate of success. So even though that still remains a very important program to the department, it's not the only avenue anymore for technology sharing and getting cooperative programs into the supply chain of the department.
One thing that I think we have seen is an increased awareness over the last year or two on the part of the Department of Defense that the portion of the industrial base that's U.S. subsidiaries of foreign-owned companies, which is kind of the bridge in between the worlds that you were talking about, that there's a relationship between the front end of that process, which is encouraging foreign direct investment through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. and a nice procedure that we've refined over the years to be nearly unworkable but still successful. The middle of that process, which is actually soliciting and receiving bids on competitive programs where U.S. subsidiaries or foreign-owned companies can participate fairly with clear access, and then the back end, which is actually the security requirements under the National Industrial Security Program that actually keeps stuff secure that should be kept secure. Well, those things sort of work sometimes at cross purposes to one another. The way to guarantee absolute security is to have no companies ever win any work, and then we wouldn't have to worry about any secrets leaving the country. Well, clearly that sort of flies in the face of the first two. And I think what we've seen over the last 2 years is a considerable effort on the part of the department to recognize that there's a continuity through that element and that we've got to make adjustments in the access to the opportunities if we're expecting companies to bid and win. And that actually benefits DOD and the federal government because you've got greater access to technology, greater access to a global skill base, greater access to innovation that's coming from everywhere. Now, that still flies in the face of the mentality that says all good new things defense are invented here first, and if we just put a big enough fence around them all, nobody else will ever get them. Well, that's not the nature of the 21st century world, and we know that. But I think the anecdotes are gradually piling up and will reinforce the policy. Inside DOD, and you probably are allowed to talk about this now, the control of the front end of that process now rests with the DASD for Manufacturing Industrial Policy, which will automatically lead you towards a greater consideration of the value to DOD from the sales and industry that you had before. And I think it'll take time for that change to take effect, but it's a very positive indication. Byron?
I'll just add, it's not just the government. The shareholders of these companies are looking for growth any way they can find it. So you go through these conference calls on earnings or investor and analyst meetings, and most of them are now putting out some percentage goal that they'd like their international sales to be a year or two out. And it's part of the pressure that I think managements are seeing is to increase that share as the U.S. budget comes down.
You've seen it. I mean, as we had double-digit year-over-year growth, you saw the inflow of companies coming into the U.S., either investing in U.S. companies or starting companies here. And I think that's a natural progression. Ellen is here. I can't see her, but she's here somewhere. She gave me this great study. I think it was a KPMG that did a study of a survey of CEOs, and the percentage that thought that their international sales would increase, almost double in the next 5 years was, over half thought they would double. So they're obviously looking toward international markets, just as domestic markets began to constrict the last 10 years overseas and they came here. It's just a natural course, I think, of the economy.
So as we wrap up here, and I don't see any final questions, and I think that's fine. I think we do have one more in the middle here. So let me hold my wrap-up thoughts. We'll see if they get changed by your question here.
Well, my question is regarding...
Name, please.
Well, my name is Abhay Kumar from Answer, and my question is regarding doing more with less. If you want to do more with less, basically you increase things like innovation and productivity. My question is there any provision in the budget for increasing either of these two things?
Yeah, I mean, when you look through what we had rolled out, Dr. Carter, when he was the Undersecretary for AT&L, in what became known as the Better Buying Power, there were 23 discrete concepts. You know, some are moving forward more rapidly than others, about getting better efficiency, and it was focused on efficiency and getting better productivity from our programs. And there was a lot of belief that that was mostly externally focused, and I can assure you it was primarily internally focused. How do we get better at buying things? How do we strengthen our own workforce to make them more agile and adopt more industry practices? So we spend a lot of time on that. And I don't remember the exact number, but there is a number that's in the budget, and I want to say it's in the high teens. It's over 50 in pure efficiencies that people have signed up to in the department, that the services have signed up to. Funds won't be released until they meet those targets, so these aren't made-up numbers, so they're realistic numbers. And it goes from everything from doing upfront requirements better, so that we don't have a lot of these the cost overruns and the changes, to operation and maintenance, total life cycle support, to logistical support. All of those are factored in. But, you know, the last decade, you know, double-digit, as I said, year-over-year growth covers a lot of sins on both the industry and the government. When programs got in trouble, when they were bleeding, we would cauterize the wound with more money. And the fact is there's no more money. So we have to stop the bleeding. And that goes to the heart of making the hard decisions early and trying to get as much productivity from both industry and our own internal folks as possible.
With that, I want to thank you all for joining us here today. I have one final comment, and it's on really the perception, the political perception and the public perception of the role of contractors in supporting our national security efforts. It's widely recognized by those of us in the national security community that the Defense Department and all of our national security enterprise has a reliance on and a dependence on the performance of contractors unlike anything we've had in our lifetimes, not only for producing the platforms and the technology and the capability, but providing all the services that we depend on to be able to surge up and bring back down again. There's a reflection that you read over and over again that somehow contractors are bad, that, in fact, it's a negative thing that the Defense Department spends money on contractors, not only for things like weapon systems, but even for food or fuel or transportation. And I think that those kinds of comments reflect really three significant key misunderstandings. One is that the government's really often not cheaper. And we've done some work on that. Many of you have seen it. If you actually compare the fully burdened cost of a government person with a contractor, it depends on the nature of the work and the type of person you have to have. It is not automatically cheaper to go to the government. It's not automatically cheaper to go to a contractor. You need to sort this out on a case-by-case basis. Second, the military especially is not cheaper, almost never. The fully burdened life cycle cost of a military person is the single most important expensive guy you can hire. And actually, the Congressional Budget Office has shown some pretty clear findings in this regard over time. And the third is that ultimately what contractors are doing is working to meet the requirements of a contract that's been determined by the government. We find it easy to attack the contractor for a problem that's really at its core, the government didn't know what it wanted in the first place and didn't know how to write a good contract to get it. Now, we don't fix that problem by firing contractors. We fix that problem by doing a better job of defining the government requirements. And that ultimately is where the reduction in the budgets, here I'm going to sort of combine my iPhone and my BlackBerry, if you will, where the reduction in the government will give you an optimistic reason to be sure that we're going to have to do better because we're going to have so much less. And maybe the Android is what you issue there as well, so that we're just actually harder working as we go on it. So thank you all for joining us today. We wish you well in this year where, in fact, you won't know what you're going to get until after the election, but it sure will be fun along the way. Thanks a lot.